Good morning, Tucson, and welcome to 1030 The Voice. This is Tipping Point. I'm your host, Zach Yenser. Daily, in-depth news, conversation, and talk about the people, ideas, and issues shaping Tucson and Southern Arizona's future. Looking forward to today's show. It's a full one. We're going to jump right into it. In just a second, be joined on the air by Hugh Hewitt, one of the top talk show broadcasters in the nation, to talk about the Heroes Act that was passed last Friday to go to consideration in the Senate and what he's learning in D.C. University of Arizona economist George Hammond makes sense of recovery here locally. Excited to have Hugh Hewitt on the air here now as we get started right away. Host of the Hugh Hewitt Show, the seventh most listened to radio broadcast in the country right now, 7 million weekly listeners. He's been a frequent guest on CNN, Fox News Network, MSNBC, written for the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Los Angeles Times. He knows what he's talking about. Hugh, thanks for coming on the air with us. How are you today?
I'm great, Zach. Good to be back. Love the KVOI audience and great to talk to you.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, appreciate it. So on Friday, the House Democrats unveiled an act called the Heroes Act, Health and Economic Recovery Omnibus Emergency Solutions Act. It passed in the House by a vote of 208 to 199. It's $3 trillion in additional stimulus proposed. Many have said that it's dead on arrival, considering the Senate, which is Republican majority, is not even really going to look at it. Let's start on the Republican side, Hugh, with what you're hearing in D.C. A big picture, even bigger than this. Are Republicans interested in an additional stimulus package? I've heard that there may not be as much appetite on the Republican side to do more stimulus. What are you hearing?
Not a chance at DOA. The House bill is It's sort of a grotesquery of $3 trillion in spending. It's called Cash for Cannabis. It mentions cannabis more than it mentions jobs. It is a grab bag of off-the-shelf wish list Democratic proposals that date back 10 years and all packaged up in a giant fire hose of cash for special interests. And so Leader McCarthy was on my show earlier this week. I had three senators on today. They're all dismissive of it. And of course, to get anything out of the Senate takes 60 votes, and they're not going to get five, much less 50 Republicans to vote for this thing. So I think that was just a marker to the special interest rump that is run by AOC and the squad, and not really a serious effort to get legislating done. Now, I do think that it is very possible a deal does get done that involves money for states for COVID-related losses. And that's hard to define because Phoenix and Arizona and Tucson, they've all lost money because of your sales tax going down. And California's been devastated because of sales tax revenue plummeting and the income tax being lost. Virginia, property tax state, so it really hasn't been a personal property tax. So it really hasn't been smashed up the way others have. There's a conversation underway about who gets what from the state government so that they don't go over a cliff, in exchange for which Mayor McConnell has said we've got to have liability protection for everyone listening to your show, Zach, who's a business person or a 501c3 or a school or any kind of institution that worries about getting sued for spreading COVID. They need liability protection. So I think that's the essential deal that will eventually get done, but no time soon.
You know, Hugh, you mentioned you characterized this in your words as a grab bag. The Heroes Act, kind of big picture, is pledging $1 trillion to state and local governments facing revenue shortfalls, $200 billion for essential frontline workers, hazard pay, a new round of direct payments to Americans. But what's interesting, Hugh, and I know you've been watching this closely, is that this was actually a compromise bill within the Democratic Party. Some of the proposals that were on the table, including a form of universal basic income, never made it into this final bill. No Paycheck Guarantee Act, no recurring $2,000 monthly stimulus checks, no automatic stabilizers. Speaker Pelosi had to tamp down some of the more progressive representatives in the House to even get this across the finish line in the House. What do you think this says about the moment we're in? Is there a conversation around the role of government and spending and stimulus on both sides of the aisle? What does this say for the future of both parties?
Well, Speaker Pelosi lost 14 members, so 14 Democrats voted against the Democrat bill because it's so radical. And it's a DOA bill that is done, what you noted, Zach, that it didn't have, you know, socialist nirvana arrive tomorrow. It's pretty doggone close. And it was close enough to get AOC to vote for it and the squad. And that drives off the half of the 30 Democrats who were elected to the House in 2018 from districts that voted for Donald Trump. They know it's electoral suicide. So I think the reality is it doesn't really represent anything except the most charismatic members of the Democratic Party are young socialists and young, quote, progressives, and they scare the living daylights out of the old classic Democrats who just really want to hang on to power, right? That's what they're all about. And they don't want the progressives have no interest in compromise. They wanted to make a big statement about New Green Deal and about special interest groups that fund them. But it's not really legislating. If you want to legislate, Pelosi walks over and sits down with McConnell. They get Mnuchin because you got to have three yeses. You got to have a President Trump signature. You need a McConnell signature and you need a Pelosi signature. This was just politics. I don't even think it was very good politics. Cash for cannabis. I just don't think that makes a lot of sense to Americans right now.
We're with Hugh Hewitt on the line right now. Of course, the one of the top radio broadcasters in the country, the Hugh Hewitt Show, which airs on this station as well. You know, before we switch over to a little bit of conversation about election 2020, Hugh, I think my last question on this is in terms of recovery and stimulus. You know, it's been interesting to watch the Fed launch a Main Street Stabilization Loan Program. It's been interesting to see Republicans, which have been very against short-term stimulus in the past, really get behind it in a big way. We've talked a lot about what the progressive wing of the Democratic Party has been pushing. It really seems, though, like in their own ways, both parties are pushing a larger form of government than they typically have in the past. Is this a watershed tipping point moment in terms of how the American people and American electeds look at the role of government? Or do you think this is just short term, we fix COVID-19 and we get back to normal in terms of our philosophy about government? Or is this like a New Deal type moment where we shift how we think about it?
Well, right now it's the latter, Zach, but it depends on how long COVID goes on. The news yesterday that there's a vaccine, it worked on 55 people, that's all, 55 people, but that was enough to send the market up almost 1,000 points. It's in a phase 2 trial now. Moderna is the name of the company, of 600 people who are 55 and older. If the vaccine works, and there are 99 other vaccines in development, if one or more of them work, everybody will revert to norm. And the Republicans will go back and say, that was a one-time deal because we medically induced coma of the economy. We had to make good. We had to send the checks out. We had to do PPP because we shut the government. We shut the businesses down, so we owed them the money. Now they can open again, and we're not doing that again. If it goes on a long time and people are afraid to resume normal economic life, then I think you'll see something like a guaranteed basic income, which is the Josh Hawley plan. Out of Missouri, great conservative senator, who thinks in terms of becoming a business interruption insurer of
right.
sorts. So if you were making X profit in May of 2019, we'll send you a check for that profit in May of 2020, that sort of thing. But it really depends upon how quickly can science either assure us or fail to assure us. They'll never say they failed, but they can. We'll be able to read if science fails to assure us, especially after yesterday's news. I mean, hopes are now up. If those hopes get dashed, it could be very rocky in the markets.
Right. Yeah, Hugh, it's I also just want to point out to our listeners that even before many of us, and certainly myself, saw the gravity of COVID-19, you were calling this out, I believe, months before it was really in the public eye. And so you've had a good sense of this thing from the beginning. How does this shape election 2020? You know, it seemed to me when I was looking at the HEROES Act that there was some subtle or maybe not so subtle messaging around Democratic priorities here as we head towards the end of 2020, and either another 4 years for President Trump or what looks like now, Joe Biden, should the Democrats win. What's the impact of this on 2020 in terms of messaging, in the sense that polls have had Joe Biden, one of the most consistent challengers to an incumbent over the long haul in the polls, pretty consistent lead. It's been that way for a while. Are the polls right? Is President Trump weaker out of this, or is he stronger out of this?
No, I think it's silly to be polling right now, because the whole, I know they have to do it. They have to generate income for their clients. They have to produce, if they're a academic institution like Marquette University up in Wisconsin, they owe a poll to their donor base, to their constituency. So they got a poll, but it's sort of like polling before a meteor strike. We have no idea what the country's mood will be in October. Mm. Literally none. Because it will depend entirely upon the course of the disease. Is there a second wave? Is there an effective therapeutic? And most important of all, is there a vaccine? If any of those things come along and the economy has begun to rebound, like yesterday's market rise of 1,000 points, Trump wins re-election. And I don't think the polls at this point have any standing. They're so far removed. I see that McSally's a little bit behind in hers. Again, It will not. None of this matters until September, when people begin to think about it. In October, they begin to vote. In November, everybody has voted by the end. That's when it matters. Mm-hmm. It's such a rapidly, like the first inning of a 9-inning game, in which both sides struck out, because mm-hmm. Trump had won. I mean, he had won re-election in January. It's the strongest economy in history. The blue collar boom. It was going to be a walk in the park, and the electoral map, the red was getting redder, the blue was getting bluer, and I just thought it was a preordained conclusion. You don't throw out a president in the middle of an economic growth. We've never had this situation before, never, where an incumbent president is facing an economic catastrophe that cannot be in good faith attributed to him. It's got nothing to do with him. It's got to do with the Chinese Communist Party. And I think most people out there realize, you know, they have tens of thousands of people dying around the world. It's got nothing to do with American government or American response. How will they judge the candidates as positioned to help get jobs back? Mm. That will be a litmus test come September and October. And I think it favors Trump, given his previous employment record. But if we have made no progress, zero, on the therapeutic side or on the vaccine side or both, It'll be tough to win re-election.
Wow. That's Hugh Hewitt with his thoughts on 2020. One more rapid-fire question, Hugh, before we let you go here, and thank you for your time. Related, Veep stakes, Hugh Hewitt. There seems to be four or five strong vice presidential candidates. Any one of them give Joe Biden a boost at this time? What's your gut hunch for the Veep stakes?
Kamala Harris. Zach, I was strong on her from the beginning. I thought she would be the nominee because she's a very gifted politician. I do believe that the candidate has to be an African-American woman. My friends in Minnesota say, it's going to be Amy Klobuchar. It's going to be Amy Klobuchar. She'll win Wisconsin. No, it's not. They have to make sure that African-American turnout approaches what it was in 2012 for President Obama. And if they don't nominate an African-American woman, and I say woman because Joe Biden promised to make it a woman, I think they'll suffer a huge expectation drop and consequent devastating damage at the polls. So I expect Senator Harris is the most electable, the most mainstream. Stacey Abrams is simply not experienced. House members simply don't rise to the level. It'd be like Geraldine Ferraro was an admission that Walter Mondale had no chance against Reagan. Kamala Harris is a great representative of California, the West, immigrant America, African-American America. I mean, she's just a terrific vice presidential choice.
And that's the word from Hugh Hewitt. Hugh, thank you so much for coming on the air with us, the seventh most listened to broadcaster right now in the country. Appreciate your pulse on things there in D.C. We talked Heroes Act. We talked election 2020. Appreciate your insight this morning. We'll have to do this again soon. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Zach, for having me on.
Absolutely. Hugh Hewitt, take care.
Bye.
And that is where we will stop for a quick commercial break. When we come back, a little bit from me, and then bottom of the hour, George Hammond, University of Arizona economist, will give us an update on the recovery, and we'll take some of this national level conversation we've started with, and we'll zoom in a little bit about what it means locally, and that's the rest of our hour. So much more to go. You just listened to the seventh most listened to radio broadcaster in the country, right here in Tucson on Tipping Point, 1030 The Voice. We'll be right back. WhyILoveWhereILive.com. It's a brand and movement that began here in Tucson to spark gratitude and celebrate the good things about where we live. Like so many local businesses right now, their physical location at the MSA Annex is dealing with changes to hours and operation, but I'm so proud of how they've pivoted to online sales and a virtual website tour of their brand new space so you can see what they're up to. Go to WhyILoveWhereILive.com right now and buy local to invest in the people that keep our economy going.
Vantage West Credit Union proudly stands with the communities we serve during these unprecedented and trying times. It's in these moments where strong communities thrive by working together. We are proud to live in a place where we help each other, even in the midst of the most difficult of circumstances. We will emerge more connected and more prosperous than ever before. Vantage West has been here since 1955. We're here now, and we will get through this together. Vantage West Credit Union, federally insured by NCUA.
How would you like a hand in shaping the future of transportation in Tucson? Well, the city's developing a plan called Move Tucson to identify and prioritize transportation projects over the next 20 years, and we want to hear from you. Head to movetucson.org to share your vision for how to improve Tucson transportation, no matter how you get around. How do you want Tucson to grow? Go to movetucson.org and let us know. Again, that's movetucson.org.
This is Bill Buckmaster. Tuesday during the noon hour, the Tuesday Moneymaker Report with financial consultant and commentator Shelley Fishman. Also, Pima County Supervisor Hopeful Dr. Matt Hines joins us, plus Pima County's Air Quality Report on Buckmaster on 1030, Tucson's voice for trusted news talk anywhere in the world live listening. We're always on at buckmastershow.com.
Tucson, welcome on back. Hope you enjoyed that conversation with Hugh Hewitt as much as I did. A really great opportunity to talk to someone who's got their pulse on the national level to get their view of what's going on. We'll talk with George Hammond, U of A economist here, in just a few moments about what this all means locally and what the road to recovery looks like. But just to wrap up some of the more national conversation, I wanted to talk about something that I do think has a local connection. But one of the things I did not make it into the Heroes Act, which again, I agree with Hugh, just from an objective standpoint, right? This is not a political statement on my part. This is just, it just is. DOA, dead on arrival. It's not going anywhere. This was more about messaging than it was about passing legislation. And of course, what the Democrats like for all those things we pass, of course. It's not like that was a laundry list of things that they didn't want. It wasn't just red meat out there, but it's not going to pass the Senate. I did want to remark, though, one of the things, and I've talked about how this has bothered me before on the show, one of the things I did not make it into the Heroes Act was a Paycheck Guarantee Act. And there's a couple of folks in the House, both R's and D's, who have looked at paycheck guarantee models. And one of the models that did not make it into the Heroes Act was a Paycheck Guarantee Act that was spearheaded by Representative Pramila Jayapal and the Congressional Progressive Caucus that would have guaranteed 100% coverage of workers' wages up to $90,000 a year. And that did not make it in. Interestingly, and this was reported on by Forbes, and I'm quoting this, interestingly, an analysis by Moody's chief economist Mark Zandi estimated that the net costs of the program, this Paycheck Guarantee Act, would be $654 billion over 6 months, comma, which is actually less than the two rounds of small business loans approved by Congress as part of the Paycheck Protection Program. This proposal would have taken out banks as the intermediary to disperse payments, instead facilitating payments straight from the IRS to employers. Hugh Hewitt mentioned Hawley's idea, which basically looks at like a disaster insurance type model. Whether you're R or D coming out of COVID-19, you have to look back and go, for the most part, at least until the very end, the Paycheck Protection Program was super rough. And the first round did not even get close to putting any sizable amount of dollars that was needed into small businesses' hands. It got adapted in the second round. It was better in the second round, but in some cases, too little too late. And there were way better models, and I think more fiscally efficient models to get real money into real people's hands, to get the real economy going. I think if the next, you know, if next, especially business recoveries keep going through the banks, there's just better ways to do it, right? And it's not a political statement. It's an efficiency statement. You could do this straight from IRS to employers. You could do it through HR companies. You could do it through insurance companies. There's so many better intermediaries. And I think I certainly tend to be a little bit more market-based driven in terms of these solutions. But you look at the cost of what we tried in two rounds to do with the Paycheck Protection Program, and a guarantee of 100% coverage of workers' wages up to $90,000 a year would have been less than that over a six-month period. I think anything that we do locally, anything that we do federally, has to be targeted towards who are the real people running real businesses of a smaller size that boost this economy. How do they get the money better, more of it, and faster? And, you know, even locally, we're finding that some of the local resiliency dollars, even from the city, are getting hung up in who and how and what. And this all just has to be a lot faster. But I saw that piece that did not make it into the HEROES Act, and it was interesting to me because right and left are now thinking, how do we get more money into the hands of people who are actually going to spend it in the economy? And we haven't always done that well. We'll be back in a minute with George Hammond, U of A economist, to localize the road to recovery. We'll be right back. 25 years ago, the University of Arizona took a bold step of acquiring an industrial park in southeastern Pima County and transforming it into a university research park. This year, we celebrate 25 years of success at the UA Tech Park. Whether it's the 20 new startups at the University of Arizona Center for Innovation or the new tech park at the Bridges that just opened up, we're celebrating this anniversary year by telling the stories and ideas of Tech Parks Arizona, moving innovation at the speed of business.
Would you like a hand in shaping the future of transportation in Tucson? Well, the city is developing a plan called Move Tucson to identify and prioritize transportation projects over the next 20 years, and we want to hear from you. Head to movetucson.org to share your vision for how to improve Tucson transportation, no matter how you get around. How do you want Tucson to grow? Go to movetucson.org and let us know. Again, that's movetucson.org.
Over the last couple of weeks, there have been a variety of both state and federal emergency funds set up to help individuals and businesses survive COVID-19. To make sure you have the best opportunity to access these resources and apply for business loans and more, you're encouraged to get your taxes in and to do it with the help of a tax professional. Give Shanae and her team at Simply Bookkeeping and Taxes a call at 520-838-0856 to get started. Tell her you heard it on Tipping Point for 50% off.
This This is Bill Buckmaster here at 1030 The Voice. We care about Tucson. Here are some things we can do together to keep our community safe. Wash your hands for at least 20 seconds. Avoid touching our faces outside of the home. When in public, please maintain a safe distance of 6 feet. Stay home if you're sick. Cover your mouth when you cough and avoid unnecessary trips into the public. We're in this together. Help us keep Tucson safe. 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk.
Tucson, welcome back to this fast-moving hour of Tipping Point. I'm your host, Zach Yenser. Every day, drive time, 9 to 10, we do in-depth news, talk, and conversation about the people, ideas, and issues shaping Tucson's future. And I'm looking forward to spending the rest of this hour with George Hammond, University of Arizona economist, to kind of localize the conversation around stimulus, or as I believe George Hammond likes to call it better, a stabilization and recovery. What does that mean for Tucson and Southern Arizona? George Hammond, welcome on the air. Thanks as always for your time.
Hi, Zach. Great to hear you.
Yes. So let's talk a little bit about federal stimulus slash stabilization and our local economy as we look at potentially a new round of stimulus. I don't think, as we've talked about, the HEROES Act is going to go far, but most people's guess is that there will be some round of federal stimulus in the near future coming out. You had mentioned earlier on during COVID-19, I would say maybe end of March, early April, George Hammond, that at first the stimulus dollars would be, you know, more spent maybe on bills and savings. Anything less would be kind of that luxury spending, but not enough, quick enough to boost the economy at first. Is that changing? Are you seeing more kind of disposable income being spent out in the economy, or are our dollars staying pretty close to vest here?
Well, Zach, there actually is some evidence that the CARES Act recovery rebate checks and the unemployment insurance assistance has contributed to some increased spending in both in Tucson and in Phoenix. There's some nice data on what they call card-based transactions. So these would include both credit cards and debit cards. And this data comes from an outfit called Opportunity Insights at Harvard, and they're tracking these card-based transactions each week, but it's daily data. And they kind of benchmark the dollar transactions currently versus what we were seeing in early January. So there's this pre-COVID spending compared to where we are at various points during the outbreak. And what we saw was this huge drop in consumer spending that was done based on these card-based transactions as we went through the second half of March and into April. And in Tucson, that spending was down, you know, about 30% compared to early January by the time we get to the middle of April. But, you know, from roughly the middle of April when we started to get the stimulus payments going out, we've actually seen the card-based transactions start to rebound a little bit. At the moment, they're down about 20% compared to early January here in Tucson. So things, I think there was a bit of a positive impact both from the recovery rebate checks and from the unemployment insurance, particularly those expanded weekly payments that have helped to sustain consumer spending a bit.
George Hammond, economist out of the University of Arizona. I want to take this in a next step, George, and that is whether it's us as Tucsonans or Southern Arizonans or folks who are maybe looking at Tucson or Arizona as a travel location, probably not by air, but maybe driving here. You've spoken about in the past that a lot of what drives Tucson's economy is disposable spending, food, drink, hotels, tourism. Are Arizonans and are maybe others who would spend money here, maybe not from Arizona, are they spending their money in that way? Is that going to benefit some of the foundations of our economy or not quite yet?
Well, the leisure and hospitality sector, the travel and tourism sector more broadly was really hard hit by the outbreak. And that's reflected in the card-based transactions. You know, that's the spending on the, you know, restaurants and bars, hotels and motels is down a lot more than overall card-based transactions. So it's down in the neighborhood of, you know, 60% or so compared to where it was in early January. So that sector will take a bit longer to bounce back, but we are actually seeing with the relaxation of some of the stay-at-home orders, we're now, you know, restaurants are allowed to open with some restrictions. And we're also tracking data on our Arizona's Economy Online magazine at azeconomy.org. We track seated diners at restaurants in Arizona and for the Phoenix metro area. Unfortunately, there's no data available for Tucson, but what we're seeing is that the seated diners at restaurants in Arizona and in Phoenix are starting to rebound a bit. You know, they were down basically 100% compared to a year ago for most of the past 7 or 8 weeks. But for the weekend of May 16th, that had begun to rebound a little bit. They're down about 80% compared to where we were a year ago. So, you know, there's still a lot of ground to make up, but that has, you know, come off the floor, and we are seeing people start to go out and eat in restaurants. And, you know, I think that's a trend that we're gonna see gradually improve. But the, you know, the big question is how fast that will go, how comfortable will people be? Because from here on out, it's going to be up to people and how safe, you know, consumers feel as they go out to retail establishments, to restaurants and bars. And, you know, how comfortable workers feel going back to work in this new environment.
What kind of consumer confidence do we have to create, George Hammond, University of Arizona economist? In other words, you know, week of May 16th, we were down 80% of seated diners. And I'm just going to throw out a number. If we can get to 50%, for example, only 50% down from January, does that get us through a couple months with some good recovery? Like, what is that benchmark? If we can get to X number, we'll be okay as we pull ourselves out of this over the next year and a half.
Well, that's something that I can't give you the number on. That's going to be an answer that will be up to each individual restaurateur, given how they've adapted. So I think we're seeing, you know, restaurants really working hard to adapt to this new environment in terms of, you know, ramping up takeout, finding ways to ramp up delivery, and now that they can have diners back in, they're looking really hard at ways to make the diners feel comfortable, make sure that they know that you know, the restaurant's following the published guidelines, and that will make the employees feel more comfortable as well about coming back to work. So, you know, we don't know how this is going to play out going forward, and that's part of the uncertainty about, you know, how fast the recovery is going to go. We just don't know for each restaurant where their break-even point is and how many diners they need to keep it going. But I would suspect it'll be more than 50% to get to a long run.
You know, you mentioned consumer confidence, George. You mentioned retail and restaurant workers who are concerned. And I'm double-checking this number, but from some of my brief research yesterday, it looks like, and this is a sad number, George, 91% of the COVID-19-related deaths in Arizona have been in the 55-plus population. But on the other side, only 9% of the deaths have been under the age of 55. Could we be projecting a little bit more confidence in the numbers we're seeing, not out of the woods yet or not that it's over, but could we be doing a better job in Southern Arizona projecting some of the more complete numbers and data picture than maybe we are? What is it on us to do to create that consumer, that reasonable consumer confidence to make that V-shaped recovery we're all hoping for?
Well, I think people are gonna judge for themselves what the risks are. The best thing that we can do is to give them information on how the outbreak is spreading through the population, to give them a sense of, as you mentioned, where the risks are in terms of the death rates. I would focus a little bit more on the hospitalization rates, which I think are a little more evenly spread across the demographics. And you want to keep in mind that those hospitalization rates are really sick people. So, you know, we want to give people the information that they can need to judge the risks for themselves. But I think, you know, we're in this transition period, right? We're opening up the economy without really having effective therapeutics and vaccines. And what you want to keep in mind is this is a for now situation. It's not a forever situation. We are going to get to the point where we have effective therapeutics and a vaccine, and the world will return to something pretty similar to what we had before. So the question is getting through the for now to the forever situation. And, you know, that's where the discussion is in terms of federal fiscal stimulus and, you know, in terms of assessing the risks and making sure that we're all washing our hands, maintaining at least a bit of a social distance when we're indoors, and wearing masks. Those are all ways that we can make other people feel comfortable being out and about and doing things that they would normally be doing.
George Hammond, before we go to our first break of our conversation here, one last stimulus question, then we'll talk some kind of future forward stuff when we get back from break. But do you think cities and states and citizens need one more round of federal help to boost us over the top? Do you think it's necessary or not sure yet?
Well, I think we're going to find out a lot in the next weeks and months. But my suspicion is that we're going to need more spending. You know, my preference would be to have the spending be more targeted on the really vulnerable populations that won't be able to return to work. So, you know, imagine somebody in the 65 and older age group, they're really not going to want to go out as long as the outbreak is still progressing through the population. I think focusing on, you know, small businesses, on unemployed individuals and people who are not going to be comfortable, and it may not be safe for them to return to work as the virus progresses, and maybe focusing some of the relief on those particular groups going forward might be something to think about.
We're with George Hammond again, University of Arizona economist. George, we're going to go to our first break. When we come back, we'd love to talk about the article that's been making waves in Tucson the last week, that we were in a Forbes top 10 best city best positioned to recover from COVID-19. I want to know what you make of that. And then we've also seen some major economic announcements out of the Phoenix area, Zoom, for one, the semiconductor facility. Certainly those deals started before COVID-19, but Phoenix is not slowing. There's an assumption that, you know, cities have to slow in these areas. Phoenix is pushing back on that. What can we do in Tucson to make that V-shaped recovery happen? That's what I'd love to get your thoughts on right after this break here on Tipping Point. 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk. We'll be right back. 25 years ago, the University of Arizona took a bold step of acquiring an industrial park in southeastern Pima County and transforming it into a university research park. This year, we celebrate 25 years of success at the UA Tech Park. Whether it's the 20 new startups at the University of Arizona Center for Innovation or the new tech park at the Bridges that just opened up, we're celebrating this anniversary year by telling the stories and ideas of Tech Parks Arizona, moving innovation at the speed of business.
So many of you listening right now are leading a successful and growing business here in Tucson. You know it depends on finding and keeping the right talent. Doing it right can help you stand out and have an edge as a leading employment brand. Wing it, and you might see a great candidate head to a competitor. The Talent Store has helped local Tucson companies like yours win the battle for talent through their recruiting services and consulting. Whether you're looking for a high-level leader, filling a key position, or just want to retain and develop your current team, visit yourtalentstore.com today for a free consultation.
Vantage West Credit Union proudly stands with the communities we serve during these unprecedented and trying times. It's in these moments where strong communities thrive by working together. We are proud to live in a place where we help each other, even in the midst of the most difficult of circumstances. We will emerge more connected and more prosperous than ever before. Vantage West has been here since 1955. We're here now, and we will get through this together. Vantage West Credit Union, federally insured by NCUA.
WhyLoveWhereILive.com. It's a brand and movement that began here in Tucson to spark gratitude and celebrate the good things about where we live. Like so many local businesses right now, their physical location at the MSA Annex is dealing with changes to hours and operation, but I'm so proud of how they've pivoted to online sales and a virtual website tour of their brand new space so you can see what they're up to. Go to WhyLoveWhereILive.com right now and buy local to invest in the people that keep our economy going.
1030 The Voice. News from inside the Beltway.
All right, Hugh Hewitt on the next Hugh Hewitt Show. My favorite historian at work in the world today is Tom Holland. He's an expert on all things Christian history, all things Roman history, and he's wonderful and he's witty and he's from Oxford and we're talking to him. In the middle of all this pandemic news, a look back at times good and bad in the ancient world with Tom Holland on the Hugh Hewitt Show.
Weekday mornings from 10 to noon on 1030 The Voice. Trusted local news and talk.
Tucson, we're back. Part two of our conversation with George Hammond, economist out of the University of Arizona, talking about local recovery. We've got about 8 minutes left. Let's jump right back in. George, I've seen a lot, as I'm sure you have, this article passed around. I've seen it in Forbes. I've seen it in Yahoo, different places, citing these Moody Analytics data that looks basically at population density and plots it against two measures of workforce quality using educational attainment, share of jobs that require a college or graduate degree, high-paying jobs. They look at proximity to a university. And it seems like they look at high-level data and say, oh, it looks like Tucson could be positioned, could be poised to come out of COVID-19 in a really strong way. What do you make of that data? If you've had a chance to look, George, is that top line data that maybe doesn't reflect some of the dynamics locally, or are you similarly encouraged that we could have a strong recovery?
Well, one thing you want to keep in mind about Tucson, particularly the educational attainment, is that we generally rank a lot higher in terms of the share of our population with a bachelor's degree or better. When you look at the 25 and older age group, when you start to break that down to the working age group, Tucson's rank actually falls pretty significantly. So I think you want to think along those lines. The key ratio is the share of the working age population. Those are the people that are really participating in the labor market the most. And they're the ones that are going to be driving the innovation and the other things that are really going to contribute to our long-run standard of living. Now, in the context of the virus, population density is one measure. I mean, that's a component of how the virus seems to be spread. You do have to be close to other people. And a lot of people are kind of looking at New York City, which is the mm-hmm. and that Northeast area, which was so hard hit, but you want to keep in mind that it's not just density; it's the how many people per household. We know that somebody who has COVID, once they have it, it's very, very likely that they'll spread it to others in the household. Communities that really depend on mass transit significantly, that tends to pack a lot of people together very closely. So Tucson benefits a bit because we don't have those kinds of household densities, and we're a much more spread out culture, as are many in the West. So we may attract, particularly in the older age groups, we may get some more migrants from the Northeast than we have in the past. But most migrants to Tucson come from California, particularly Southern California, and other states in the West. And we have long been a really attractive destination for those people, and we're going to continue to be a really attractive destination. So I think we should be optimistic about Tucson's long-run future. We're going to continue to attract a lot more people than we lose to other states. And that will be good for the real estate market, retail, and other consumer-oriented businesses.
I think the key word in that article that I keep getting hung up on is positioned. I did see some people basically, remark, yay, we're a top 10 city. Like, no, we could be. Some of the numbers are in our favor, but I think there's a lot that work we need to do to get there. I look at, we've got about 4.5 minutes, so we'll probably close on this, George, but I look at the recent announcements. We had two in about a week's period both in Phoenix, the Zoom Research and Development Center, one in Pittsburgh, one in Phoenix, really relying on workforce talent out of Arizona State University. And then, of course, the Taiwan Semiconductor Facility. Certainly those deals started well before COVID, but Phoenix is certainly not slowing down out of this, and we're not seeing any fear about these companies moving there. I have to think that Tucson may need to be similarly energetic about some intentional economic development to pull out of this in a more diversified way. Do you agree, and what does our path to recovery need to look like if we're going to take advantage of that top 10 potential?
Yeah, I think you know, what I'm hearing out of the economic development community is that they are aggressive and optimistic about, say, you know, the firms that were you know, considering Tucson pre-COVID or still considering Tucson as a place to locate. You know, we are eventually going to have effective therapeutics and a vaccine for COVID. And, you know, firms, when they make large investment decisions, they think long term. And, you know, the long term, you know, Tucson is going to grow and expand. And these kind of business locations, Tucson will be attractive in some ways. We have the University of Arizona. You know, we do have a significant share of our population with a bachelor's degree or better with STEM degrees. There are a lot of highly productive, highly educated people here in Tucson that makes us attractive for certain kinds of large businesses.
If you had to look at our workforce, George, and you kind of hinted at it when you were diving into the data in that Forbes article, are there any workforce either shifts or upskills or any sector we need to develop a workforce around to be competitive in this new economy?
Yeah, well, continuing to focus on, you know, workforce development is going to be key. You know, the human capital, it has been a key driver of innovation and our long-run standard of living during the past 30 years, and it's going to be, you know, at least as important or more important during the next 30 years as we start to automate larger and larger shares of the economy. So, you know, education, educational attainment, and workforce development are still going to be key factors that will propel Tucson towards the top of the pack or not, depending on what we decide to do.
George, as we wrap up, any specific segments of the workforce that you'd recommend, again, to take advantage and keep going back to that Forbes top 10 article? I think back to, I had Michael Crow on the show, president of ASU, last Friday, and they put about a 10-year effort into growing about a 20,000 per year population engineering school. Really intentional, and that's, of course, what Zoom is relying on. Is there any type of workforce here, about a minute to go, George, that we need to focus on upskilling right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think what I think about when I think about the future workforce demands, I think about leadership skills, I think about creativity, problem-solving skills, and then, you know, the high-tech skills, information technology, and, you know, basic and advanced digital skills are going to be what will make us most competitive, particularly as we look to an increasingly automated future.
George Hammond, as always, thank you for your time. It's always a fast 25 minutes. That's where we're going to have to stop today, but we try to have you on monthly, and especially now as we figure out how do we get that V-shaped recovery that we know is possible and that we all want, pull ourselves out of COVID-19 and get back to what was a booming Arizona economy, double the job growth, I believe, of the rest of the country back in January. So we'll have you on again to talk us through that, to walk us through that. And as always, thanks for your time. I appreciate it, George.
Great. Thanks, Zach.
George Hammond, Arizona, University of Arizona economist. That does it for us today. We'll be back same time, same place on Wednesday, 9 a.m. here on 1030 The Voice. Hugh Hewitt coming up and Bill Buckmaster after that, as always, at noon. We'll see you later, Tucson. Stay healthy. Take care.